welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Dr. Greg Corbin, who is the author of Beyond Reason, Lessons from the Loss of a Gifted Child. Dr. Corbin is an anesthesiologist who, after being trained at Duke and other prestigious places, and entering into a life of a busy life of anesthesia, similar to the life of surgery that I had a spiritual experience when he lost a gifted child, and that led to him embarking on a journey, which he's here to tell us about today. Thank you for joining us, Greg. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you, Susan. Thanks for having me.
So, your book starts out with the day that Brian died. Do you want to tell us a little bit about Brian and how you came to write the book?
Well, sure. Brian was 9, and he died playing baseball. He was a really gifted kid. He was smarter than I was, and very artistic, and he could write poetry and things like that that I couldn't even hope to do. He was a real entertainer. He was a real character, so he was a real joy. Whenever he was around, there was always something going on. So right before his 9th birthday in January, when it was time for us to plan his party, he told us that he didn't want to have a party, that it would bring his death closer, and that he wouldn't live till double digits, which he meant was age 10. And then he became very introspective and got progressively more depressed, had trouble sleeping, became obsessed by thoughts of death. And my wife's a minister and pastoral counselor, and my specialty was pain management, which is mostly psychology, and I'd always been around psychologists and psychiatrists. And between the two of us, we couldn't make a dent in this, in what was going on. We couldn't understand anything about what Brian was telling us. And we got so desperate that we took Brian to a psychologist, child psychologist. And they really enjoyed their time together because the psychologist taught Brian psychology. And Brian taught Dr. Dan, the psychologist, about the inner workings of his mind, and with some kind of hints of mystical knowledge. So they enjoyed their time together and became great friends, but we didn't discover any new issues to deal with. And then come spring, as the weather got warmer and brighter, Brian started coming out of his depression. Now, during this time, we had really asked for help from just about everybody to try and help us, because Brian's work at school was falling off, so we had the teachers involved and the school psychologist and friends and people at church. So there were probably about 50 people that knew that we were dealing with this issue. And then about 3 weeks before Brian died, he said it was time for his party. And about that time, there were a lot of other things going on that weren't in my belief system, because I had been trained as an academician, as a scientist, and I had been told that there was no evidence for any kind of paranormal activity, that it was all like a fraud. And so yeah, my belief system was pretty much mainstream. The stuff that you learn in school and on TV and stuff like that. But all these things were happening, and I didn't understand at the time. But his picture, when he told us it was time for his to schedule his party, the latest picture, photograph we had of him that we had framed began to fade. And about a week before he died, it was so bad that we had to order a new one. And lots of other things going on. But so we scheduled this party, and during that few weeks before his party, Brian sort of became organized, which was kind of out of character for him. And he had like a list of things that he was trying to finish up, like write his grandparents. And he died the day before Mother's Day, which was on a Sunday, and he died on a Saturday. And he insisted I get Catherine, my wife's Mother's Day present in advance. He wrote her a nice poem for her. And then even more unusual, he insisted to Catherine that she get my Father's Day present, even though that was months away. And he made friends with the bullies at school and a lot of things. We didn't realize, but he was tying up all of his loose ends. Mm-hmm. And then 2 days before he died, my wife was driving down the driveway, and Brian had been talking about taking a trip with increasing frequency. And one day he would say it would be to Montana, and another day to Wisconsin or something like that. And it just seemed like a kind of a fantasy game for him. He was very much like Calvin of Calvin and Hobbes. He got a lot of the ideas for pulling pranks on people and on us as parents from Calvin and Hobbes. Like he memorized all the books. And if he ever wanted to tell us a funny joke, he'd just tell us the book number and the page number, and we'd look it up, and that would be the point he wanted to make. And he would do things like, he got the idea that Calvin locked the babysitter in the bathroom, so Brian thought that'd be fun. So he locked the babysitter in the bathroom, so we'd get this prank call from the babysitter, and Brian's locked her in, and we've got to go convince him to unlock the room. He also started doing a parents' poll, which he got the idea from Calvin. And Calvin used the parents' poll to kind of torment his parents. Mm-hmm. So Brian did the same thing. If we ever told Brian to do something he didn't like clean up his room, you know, then there'd be a parents' poll prominently posted, a couple hours later, showing our low approval scores, something like that. So anyhow, Catherine was coming home, and there she sees halfway down the driveway is Brian pulling his little red wagon with his teddy bears and his camping gear. And she asks Brian what he was doing. And he said, well, it's time for me to go on my trip. So she gets out of the car and sits on the ground next to him and puts him in her lap and says, well, Brian, you know, if you go, I'll miss you terribly. And he said, well, you don't understand. This is something I have to do. I can't be a wimp. You know, I have to go. And she said, well, I'll tell you what, you have your party in 2 days, so you can't go now. So let's pitch the tent in the backyard tomorrow night, the night before the party, and you can camp out with Sasha, our dog, and that will be your trip for now. And he had tried that in the past, but he'd always been afraid of the dark. Mm-hmm. So this time he thought that this would be a good challenge for him, and he thought that was a good idea. So Catherine drove back, and Brian took his wagon and turned around and happily came back up the driveway. The next day, we got the house ready for his party, and then we pitched the tent, and then he spent the night out with Sasha, our dog. Now, there's all kinds of other stuff that goes, the story goes and goes in all kinds of different directions, but I didn't really realize till later that Sasha was probably the bravest being, the most courageous being that I'd ever been around. One time I was running and she was with me, and three dogs. She was an Eskimo dog, about 40 pounds, mostly fur, and real sweet. And these three big, mean-looking dogs came down this hill, obviously to attack her or to attack us. And you heard the story that it's not the size of the dog in the fight, but the fight in the dog. Mm-hmm. So they came down, and I'd never seen anything like it, but Sasha was turned into a buzzsaw, and I'd never seen such fury. And she basically, the fight was over in about 1 second, and the three much larger dogs just took off running away from her. So what I think was going on was she was helping give her courage to Brian that night before he had to face his different tests, one of which was sleeping out at night. So he spent the night out, came in the next morning, and he was very proud of himself for overcoming his fear of the dark. And then it was the most beautiful spring day, and this was the day he died. It was the most beautiful spring day you could possibly imagine. clear blue sky, crisp, clear, and you can see the mountains from our house, the Blue Ridge Mountains. And unusual for that time of year, the honeysuckle was out, so the air was sweet with honeysuckle. And he wanted, for his party, it was going to be a happy spring party, not a real birthday party. He didn't want presents, and he just wanted his three best friends. So his three friends came, his little girlfriend, Jamie, and his best friend, Ben, and another boy, Cammie, that had always wanted to make friends with him. And this was kind of like Brian was finishing up some unfinished business in reciprocating Cammie's friendship. And they played, and they had a great time for a couple hours. And then it was time for the parents to pick the kids up. And then Brian had his baseball game in about an hour. So we went to his room and finished up some things that we didn't see till later. One of which was he put a sign on his door. And he'd also, during that 2 to 3 weeks, from the time he told us it was time for his party, started putting up signs on his door. And they were often humorous. Like, Brian's on a trip, don't worry about me, or something like that. No, I mean, like, keep out Brian's room, something like that. Well, today, he'd written, Brian's on a trip, don't worry about me. And then he also did a parents poll, which we didn't see till after he died. And he drew it up and then left it out right where we could see it when we came in the front door. And for the first time, he'd given us a perfect 2,000, the highest score. And he wrote a couple letters to some other girls in his class. Now, he just had his girlfriend over, and she gave him a little kiss. That was her birthday present. But he really liked girls. So he wrote a couple letters to a couple other little girls in his class. And then it was time for him to go to his baseball game. So we put on his uniform, put everything out where we could find it. And then we drove out to the baseball game. On the way, by the end of our driveway, he said, well, I have to mail these letters. And so he put them in the mailbox, but they didn't have stamps on them. And I said, no, you have to understand, he was really smart. And he knew, I mean, this wasn't, you know, a dumb kid. And I said, Brian, you know this won't get mailed without having stamps on them. And he says, you don't understand. They will get there. And he was very determined, so rather than arguing with him, we put him in the mailbox. I took him to the baseball game. Now, this was his second baseball game that he'd ever, that he'd been in Little League. The first was the week before, and I had encouraged him to join a Little League team because he was such a cerebral little kid and artistic, and I thought it would be good for him to you know, be a little more balanced. But he was the littlest kid on the team, not really good at baseball. And he was afraid of the hardball, so it was kind of a stretch for him. But he kind of went along with it because to try and please me. And on the way to the baseball field, though, he was very enthusiastic. He was looking forward to it. And the game before, his first game, he'd been stranded at third base and never made it home. So this time he said he wanted to score a run more than anything. Then we got to the baseball field, and he was jumped out of the car. He was a different kid. He had lost all of his fear, and he was, charging after the hard ball and leaping up in the air to catch fly balls and begging the coach to make him the pitcher, which he wasn't good enough to do, but his heart was in it. And then it was his first time to come up to hit, and he came up to the plate, and he was so little he got walked to first base. The next little boy hit a triple, and Brian tore around the bases, got waved home. Crossed home plate, we were all standing up and cheering him, and he was the happiest little boy you can imagine. His eyes were shining. He looked over at me and gave me a thumbs up and then trotted over to the dugout and giving everybody high fives all the way to the dugout and then sat down and then fell over. He had an arrhythmia and died. And the kids in the dugout said, yo, Brian, because he was always kidding around. He said, quit kidding around. But then the coach brought him out. And a hush fell over the crowd, and I tried to resuscitate him. The rescue squad was right across the street, and they showed up within a minute. And I thought, it should be an arrhythmia. We should be able to get him back. But I've resuscitated many people in my career and brought many people back. But I looked at his little blue face, and I just knew he wasn't coming back. And so that was the end of his life, but it was not the end of the story. That was just the first chapter in the book.
Right. Well, the book goes on to describe your, I guess, you go through a period of grief, and then you notice that a lot of synchronicities and things that are difficult to explain start happening, and you yourself open into another world.
Right. Well, the way Brian died and all the different things, there were several things that happened that day that started becoming, you know, a lot of that people would call paranormal.
Mm-hmm.
I went to the baseball field right after we left the emergency room after he died, and we said goodbye to his body, and we went to the baseball field, and I reached up to wipe a tear from my eye, and the sour smell of Brian's vomit on my hand from the resuscitation blended with the sweet honeysuckle in the air. And then all of a sudden, the colors got brighter than I had ever seen them before, and the smells and the sounds. And I was completely at peace. And I knew that Brian had finished his work here. He'd conquered his fear, which is more than most of us do. And he had taught, you know, his life was now going to be a real lesson for the rest of us, and that the rest of the work was mine. The rest of, you know, the work, if I could bring him back, it would just be for me, not for him. So I had that moment of peace and understanding that kind of, I'd never experienced anything like that before, although I've since read that other people have had similar experiences. And then we went back home, and then we saw that he left his parents' poll and his note out for us to see. And we probably had 100 people that came to our house that night to come and visit and comfort us. And they all saw the sign and the parents' poll too. And then that night, we also had a younger daughter who was 2 years younger than Brian, named Lynn. And she was mentally handicapped. And she couldn't understand that Brian was what death meant, and that Brian wouldn't be coming home again. So I, later that night, I'm still in shock, as you can understand. And I was not a religious person, even though we went to church because my wife was a minister. I was an agnostic, and I'd never really felt comfortable with death or talking about any of these things. So here I am tucking my daughter in, and I get into bed with her, and I tried to explain, you know, that Brian has died, and he's gone to heaven, and he won't be coming home anymore. And she say, "He take airplane?" And I said, "Well, no, Lenny, when you die, you leave your body like a butterfly leaves its cocoon, and then you can fly without an airplane." Oh, that was one more thing. There were, during that 3 weeks from the time he scheduled his party, both he and Lynn became obsessed with butterflies, and we had butterflies all over the house, and, you know, we're reading storybooks about them and painting them and all kinds of stuff. So that, you know, I said that, and then she said, "Oh, I said it dark," and then she looked up at the ceiling, and then she got this most beautiful smile on her face, and her eyes focused on something beyond the ceiling. She could obviously see something. And then all of a sudden the bed began vibrating, and then I saw this rippling river of energy waves that were carrying us along. And I knew that they'd always been there, I just couldn't see them before, and that Brian was still part of it. So that lasted for a few minutes, and then I just knew that my life was changing direction. And then what this river was would be kind of like a quest that would take me for several years and on many adventures that I couldn't have imagined.
And you were lucky enough to live close to the Monroe Institute, which is an expert area of not only explaining these different states of consciousness, but helping induce them.
Well, as it turns out, I live in Charlottesville. I came here to teach at the University of Virginia, and it's a very interesting small college town. But I didn't know until after Brian died and had all of these questions. My belief system was totally blown away. And I was, and I obviously knew that there was more going on to reality than I'd been taught. And then it turns out that the very best teachers in the whole world to teach me about what had happened were right here in Charlottesville.
Isn't that neat?
In my own backyard.
Right.
Yeah. The very first books about out-of-body experiences in the Western literature, that was from Bob Monroe. That was here in Charlottesville. The very first books about near-death experience and life after death, that was Raymond Moody and George Ritchie, and they were from here. The very first books on reincarnation and evidence for reincarnation came from Ian Stevenson. That was in Charlottesville. There's even more. The oldest ongoing commune in the country is from here. And you go way back to Madison, Monroe, and Jefferson. They lived here. And they embodied the highest level of consciousness in a government document, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, that has still ever been done, was embodied in, and that came from here, Charlottesville. So it seems to be a place that attracts people on the edge of consciousness that are kind of increasing the level of human consciousness. So all of these synchronicities showed up, and I ended up meeting Bob Monroe, and invited me out to lunch because he was looking for anesthesiologists to work on a study using some of his sound technology. He was a very successful radio entrepreneur in the 50s and noticed that some of the sound that he was experimenting with gave him out-of-body experiences. And then the government started using that for some of their remote viewing and other kinds of secret research in consciousness that the military was doing. And so Bob was quite a find. And I ended up going there for many years. And I had some incredible experiences. It was a magical place for me.
I hadn't gotten a chance to go there, but I interviewed Paul Rademacher 3 times on the radio show. And he's invited me up there. I'd love to go. But
yeah,
I also interviewed Joseph McMonagle about 5 times. The last time was 3 months after 9/11. Mm-hmm. And I asked him, I said, Joseph, does the government know where Osama bin Laden is? And his answer was, the government knows exactly where Osama bin Laden is.
Yes.
So.
Yeah. Now, Joe, so I'm sure your listeners know, he's U.S. Military remote viewer 001. He was the first, and he's still the best in the world.
Okay.
So about one, if you give him, an envelope with a picture in it, which is one of 4 pictures, he'll get it right 50% of the time, but he'll draw it exactly, almost exactly 25% of the time. Mm-hmm. And if it's a nuclear facility, he'll draw it right every time.
Right.
I mean, it's, that's as good as remote viewing gets. So, in other words, all this talent, right, like Joe McConnell
right
and all these people, yeah. Skip Atwater, that formed the first remote viewing unit in the intelligence community, which was trying to copy what the Russians were doing. He's
right.
Here, and the fellow who wrote the book Magical Child, who actually was a mentor to Bob Monroe, Joseph Chilton Pierce. Are you familiar with Joe?
I've interviewed him 4 times.
Oh, you have?
Each book.
Great.
Well,
that's
I've been
great.
Doing the radio show 17 years.
17
Can you
years,
imagine?
Wow. So you've been touched all the bases.
Every week I talk with somebody.
Well, that's great. Well, Joe became my mentor for many years, and he kept telling me all of his adventures. He travels all around the world and goes to all the cutting-edge conferences, and he meets all of these avatars, these kids, the most incredibly gifted kids all around the world. And he helps the parents and all the other people kind of, understand each other. And so you could not ask if all the people on the planet that would help teach me about a magical child like Brian, it was Joe.
Really?
So, and Joe would tell me all these incredible stories that, and I kept saying, Joe, you need to write this stuff down. This is, because at this point, I had spent years reading everything I could about paranormal stuff and trying to understand what was real and putting it together with what had happened and was still going on in my life. And I had not read any stories as good as Joe's. And I said, but he said, nah, he's a kind of a modest fellow. But he has had such incredible experiences that I've learned from. I'm really grateful.
Yeah, there's the Monroe Institute really was one of the first places where the great minds gathered to really promote consciousness research and push us forward in that area. And
yeah,
I think Skip and Paul run it together right now. I think Paul.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
And
I haven't interviewed Skip, but I'd love to.
Oh yeah, he's a good interview, and
he's
had a wealth of experience too. I mean, there are very few people you can talk to on the planet that have had the experiences these guys have had.
Right.
So basically, what I learned was that through my experiences, that first let me tell you about what happened after I started attending the support group for people that have lost parents have lost children.
Okay.
And it's called the Compassionate Friends. And we were about a year after Brian died, we could go. We'd recovered enough that we could go to the support group. And then it was another year after that before I could talk about Brian's death,
mm-hmm.
you know, without crying. And there would be about 20 people in the room, and it was a really very helpful to hear that other people that had gone through the same thing you did who were ahead of you, and then you tell about, you know, your dreams, and they say, oh, we had the same dream.
Mm-hmm.
Find out
right.
The same dreams happen over and over again, and they start to form a pattern, and the pattern is very healing when you know this, that there really is a path going on mm-hmm. with grief, and that the children... And when they show up in your dreams, are often it's very helpful to the people. They usually show up and say that they're okay, not to worry about them. That's the I'm okay dream. That's the second of the three kinds of dreams that I recognized. So I told a 5-minute version of Brian's story for this group of parents. And then the other parents started chiming in with their own what would be called paranormal experiences with their kids. And about half the parents that were still living with their kids had stories very similar, but they had not been free to talk about them. And then once the ball started going rolling, you started realizing, when I talk to groups of parents, grieving parents, now whenever I talk, I will talk for a little bit, and then you know the other parents are going to start chiming in with their own stories. And a lot of these stories are really wonderful. We had the first time we did that, there was a 12-year-old boy who died in a car accident. And the night before he died, he wrote a list of his life accomplishments and sat down with his mom and went over them and talked about what he wanted to accomplish in the future, which was out of character for him.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had a 4-year-old little girl, and I worked with her mom in the hospital. She was a radiology tech. And this little girl... was sounded a lot like Brian, really gifted, artistic, full of joy. The mom said this little girl every day would say to the mom, you know what, I love you with a mad passion. You can imagine that's a 4-year-old. And this little girl died at her daycare center. She went on a slide, and a ribbon caught around her neck and strangled her. And this little girl, the mom brought in, talked about the picture, and then brought it in to work where I could see it a couple days later. And half an hour before she died, this little girl drew a picture of her hanging by the neck, obviously dead, in dark colors. And then on the other side of the picture was her in bright colors putting on a yellow halo with an angel in the sky dropping more halos down to her. And this mom said, you know, my daughter always said that she never wanted to grow up and go to school like the other children.
Right.
But she was joyful. And so you hear it. I mean, and now I've collected so many stories. That's one thing I wanted to do with my website, beyondreason.info, was that I realized that people don't have a place to share these stories.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you do, you see that they're very common and that they form a pattern. And that the child's death is an opening for the parents and for everybody to, you know, to follow and to grow, which is...
This also brings up the idea of a death date, which I started a cancer clinic here in 99, and I became real clear early on that we do have death dates. And Deepak Chopra describes this in the Book of Secrets, where he talks about going to a Rishi master and getting a scroll that was done 5,000 years ago by a master, and on it is everything, his name, his mother's name, father's name, his brothers and sisters, where he goes to school, who he marries, his children, his career, and then finally at the end of the death date. So obviously, if these things can be, you know, prophesized to that degree, we have certain things that are not changeable in our life. In other words, they're soul contracts. So one of the things you have to know when you start taking care of cancer patients is, when is their death date? People generally don't live too long beyond their death date. I know my father lived 2 weeks after his death date, but he was in a real weird place. You know, it wasn't quite right because he was supposed to die on his death date, and he didn't. So this would explain, if we live in a compassionate world full of beings not in this dimension that are here to help us, the children with a death date right in front of them would be given help in many ways so that they could go through that with less fear and, you know, and problems.
Well, we all have help. It's really a question of whether we accept it or not. But yeah, children are closer, definitely closer to all of this. And I talk about that, all the things I learned from Joe. And then when I had, we had another child a few years after Brian died, named Matthew. And so, and now all the things, you know, I wish that I knew these things back when Brian was dying or was preparing for his death, because he really was, he was alone. Nobody really understood that he really did know what was going on. And we kind of denied his, so he was in many ways kind of isolated. But now when I, I'm around children, I'm very aware of the fact they kind of live in this dream world. And then that really is the intermediate state where that's kind of what we do at the Monroe Institute, is that you just basically go into dream states. It's like lucid dreaming when you're asleep and you're aware that you're dreaming and you can control it, which is much more difficult than very deep meditation, which is like same thing, dreaming awake. At the Monroe Institute, where the sound technology helps you, and so does the field effect of all the other people that have been there before. And then you go into these dream states, and you find out the deeper you go, the more real they are. And they're actually more real than this reality, and they're much more intelligent.
And inner so, space, not outer space.
Right, right. And it's actually, it's no space after a while, because space and time is a construct of the mind. And
that's right.
When you get, you know, when you get to the point where the mind is no longer in control, then space and time becomes very dreamy. Mm-hmm. And then the trouble is, you know, the more you do that, then you have, and you come back and into this world, you're more aware. And what you're aware of is all of the falseness and all of the, the journey of enlightenment is a two-edged sword. The more aware you are and the more ecstatic the realms you go to, the harder it is to come back.
Yeah.
And then also,
you do get a detachment for what's here, too, that's helpful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a healthy detachment that you
right.
realize that if time and space are constructs, and there's a lot of evidence that that's true, then the world we live in is a constructed world for a purpose, and not the real world, eternity, where we are, we would call home.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're unhappy with what you have in this world, then you work to change it through spiritual principles that you learn. But you know all the time that this is just a, you know, a schoolyard or a, you know, a classroom, not really where you're really from.
Mm-hmm.
And,
right.
I think it makes it easier. I mean, it makes it easier for me.
Well, it's like when you have a foot in both worlds.
Yeah.
It's nice knowing that this really is only a small part of it, and it really is a stage. So you can do your bit on the stage, play your role, play your role as well as you can. But of course, mm-hmm. at some point, this plays over, and you're still there. And
if you don't have attachments here, it makes it a lot easier.
It does.
I mean, it always does, because Buddha, you know, Buddha said that the cause of all suffering is these attachments, which probably is true. You know, your attachments to your ideas of what you think should be here.
Right, and that depends on your understanding of attachment. Of course, there's the grasping, which is to try and fill your emptiness attachment, mm-hmm. which is what I think he's referring to there. And then there's the real attachments, which are the real connections we have
mm-hmm.
through our essential qualities of love and courage and truth and all of these things. And those are the true attachments or bonds.
But they don't disappear when you leave here.
No, not at all.
I mean, because they're not artificial. You take those with you. I mean, the attachments and bonds you have with, you know, with Brian and with your family members, you will survive there, no longer being on this plane.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Well, that's the only thing that you
those are real.
Yeah, that's the only thing that is real. And
right.
So all of the other things that people are striving for here turn out to be absolutely completely unimportant.
Right. You know, stuff you can't take with you. You know, your bank account, your possessions, your social status. You know, don't go out with you. So.
Yeah, your power. You know, you're the power that comes from emptiness, from a lack of all of these essential truths. Right.
Yeah, you have a story in your book that I found interesting. Was when you went to the race, you know, the racetrack to learn to drive cars quick, and who you encountered there. I thought that was an interesting observation of human striving and the emptiness that we all have to overcome.
Yes, that was. That was. I think that was about 2 years after Brian died, and. A friend of mine, Chris, invited me to go with him to race car driving school down in Sebring, Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I had always been doing adrenaline sports. And one thing I discovered after Brian died was that I had always been grieving all my life, but I never had a reason for it. I'd always felt this tremendous emptiness.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to escape it, I had done all of these achievements and adrenaline sports. And I'd pushed myself to where I really should be dead,
mm-hmm.
at least four times over. I mean, it really is. There was really divine providence that got me here, so that I could be talking to you on the radio.
You have a death date, and it's not. It's in the future.
Right, but I mean, so. I had. I was taking flying lessons and. I had the world's worst flight instructor. I was his first student, and I had later on went and got my commercial rating at the same place he trained, and they still told, this was years later, and they still mm-hmm. told stories about how bad he was. I mean, he had been the only one who had retracted the landing gear on a twin-engine plane while they were still on the ground.
Oh, no.
Yeah, his name was Joe. Well, Joe had the world's worst judgment. Of course, I didn't know that. So he took us at night for a night landing on this dirt strip after this huge rain.
Oh, no, mud.
And so we landed on it, and it was all mud. And he said, you know, don't stop, we'll never get off, you know. Mm-hmm. Got it. And then we went to the end of the runway, spun around, and tried to take off. I mean, the mud's flying everywhere, and instead mm-hmm. of taking off the middle of this little runway in the middle of nowhere, you know, we were taking off at the very end.
Mm-hmm.
And the last thing I remember was looking at the trees with the landing light, the headlight,
mm-hmm.
and with trees going straight up to the sky. I mean, we were about...
How am I going to get over those?
We were like 10, you know, we were like 2 seconds from hitting these trees.
Right.
And it was a high-wing plane. And all of a sudden, everything got into a dream state.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, and everything got very still.
Mm-hmm.
And then the trees went by both my windows, did mm-hmm. not touch the plane at all.
Right.
Somehow we got through that, and it was just like, it was like
that was an intervention by your guardian angel.
I know.
And that's how you tell, because of that altered state of consciousness when it's happening.
Right. Well, I didn't know that at the time, but I remember thinking mm-hmm. this is really weird, you know, whatever happened there.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that should not have happened.
Yeah.
So, okay. So I had always pushed myself to within a whisker of death
mm-hmm.
just to try and, you know, escape my own emptiness, my own pain.
Right.
And we went to race car driving school, and this was, I'd done a lot of different things. I mean, I'd done everything. I jumped out of airplanes, and I, you know, free dived underwater without any equipment down to 60 feet. Everything you could think of, I had done it. And so here were all these guys, and these were like super achievers, men in their 30s and 40s, corporate raiders. One guy flew in on his private jet. Some South American playboy came up there. He wrecked, every day he would wreck a car and pay for it. So over 5 days, he bought five cars, you know. And as I got to see what was going on here, it's like these guys were just like me, only even more so.
Mm-hmm.
And we get out on the racetrack, and we drive round and round in these circles, you know, with as much adrenaline as we could imbue mm-hmm. it with. And then we always pulled back to the same place again. We'd always come back to the pit. And then we weren't really accomplishing anything with all of our, you know, deals and power and the illusion of control and all these things. And I just looked around and I realized I'd always been doing that too. And then now it was time for me to stop doing that and to actually explore my emptiness and my pain that had been offering itself all these years, and I'd always run away from it. So after I finished that trip, actually did it twice, I came back and I was in the hospital cafeteria talking to a nurse friend of mine who runs mm-hmm. the cancer center, and Faye, who is you know, a very, you know, very compassionate woman. And I said, well, you know, this race car driving was the last thing I wanted to do as a kid that I hadn't done. Now that I've finished that, I wonder what's next for me.
Mm-hmm.
And she sort of changed the subject and started talking about this fellow that she had worked for a couple years before, named Robert Monroe.
Really?
She had just taken, she was single, and she mm-hmm. took this job just, I guess, to kind of, you know, give her a part-time job to give her something to do.
Mm-hmm.
And she was working for this guy who was running the local cable company, and mm-hmm. she got these messages from him, and they were pretty weird,
mm-hmm.
like people talking about out-of-body experiences or something like that, or wanted mm-hmm. him for interviews. And she mentioned that to me. And then, you know, a couple weeks later, or about a week later, I was taking a bicycle course.
Mm-hmm.
Because I wanted to start commuting by bike. Now, mm-hmm. one thing that happens that's universal for parents that have lost children, mm-hmm. that have had children die, is no matter what your religious belief or anything like that, we all lost our fear of death.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd always wanted to ride my bike to work, mm-hmm. but it was very dangerous, and every year people get killed.
Right.
The roads are really narrow and windy, and the people had always told me not to do it. But I'd lost my fear, and I decided I would go ahead and start bike commuting. And I took a bike course. I was the only one over the age of 12 in the bicycle course. And the guy who ran it was named Scott, and he invited me out to his place. And I wrote it down, turn left, turn right, turn, go past Monroe Institute. What's that? Oh, he said, well, they're really nice. They let us get married there and in charges. They do some government stuff. And it turns out, so I went there that weekend. I happened to have free, which never happens for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to meet him, and I got to meet his father-in-law, next-door neighbor, Joe Pierce.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of the beginning of my, you know, of my journey.
Yep. The things you're supposed to do are put right in front of you. All you have to do is recognize that they're there.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, this the emptiness that we have, and it turns out that everything, you know, every action we do is because of our emptiness. In other words, every time you drink some water, it's because you're missing water. You need it.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned that when I was doing some drama work as a director. That was the big breakthrough in direction with Stanislavski, mm-hmm. the Russian director. And the only thing you have to know to bring a character to life is what they're missing at that moment, what they mm-hmm. want, and the clearest action to show it to the audience. And so you don't, you know, before that, people had these elaborate ways of getting into the character. But that's really the only thing that drives that character in the action of the play and drives life is the what we're missing and how we're trying to fill it. And so what I realized when I was exploring my grief and with a lot of other people that were grieving is that it's a matter of degree. And then when it takes over your life and you're only a part of this huge emptiness, that it is, you know, that's a path. The emptiness, your incompleteness, is your path, mm-hmm. your spiritual path to growth. And if you accept what shows up, you know, you will end up someplace different than you could have conceived.
Mm-hmm.
But we're taught in our society that there is no magic and that the emptiness, you know, is to be feared.
Mm-hmm. Just there's really only one problem, and that's the sense of separation from God. And all other problems drop away once you're able to, you know, reunite with Source. The trick is taking it back into your everyday life. You know, I'm a plastic surgeon, so you know how I spend my days, you know, in surgery. And, you know, if you're doing the same thing I'm doing, you say you're running a outpatient surgery center now, is that right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Orthopedics. So, you know, we're in similar environments. The trick is bringing it back into the day-to-day life that we're leading and being able to follow the guidance that comes from that that overcoming the sense of separation through meditation and other spiritual practices, bringing it back into what is happening every day. And some days we do better than others, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but walking in meditation or walking in this state of being, which is really, if you can do it every day, that's enlightenment.
Mm-hmm. Well,
it's not just becoming enlightened for, you know, a few hours when you're in a shamanic journey or in a Monroe, you know, exercise.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. People would go for these week-long retreats at Monroe Institute, and mm-hmm. then you'd come back, and you get these great mm-hmm. stories about people coming back, all these disasters that befall.
Well,
it's kind of bringing
you
back to
reality. Is what you have to do. It's not. Many people say it's easy to be enlightened on the mountaintop with nobody around to annoy you. You know.
Oh right, but, sure. Yeah, that's that's why we have in-laws.
That's why we have in-laws. How true. I never got married, so I didn't have the pleasure of having an in-law. One uh-huh. petty tyrant I avoided. I didn't avoid others, though. I had other petty tyrants in my life. So.
Oh, there are infinite numbers. Yeah,
there are.
It's like, but I think that all of these exercises and practices, mm-hmm. you know, all the spiritual practices are just to build up the trust, trust the everyday. Because it's really tough. I mean, you have a child die. I mean, there's nothing worse that can happen.
It may be the toughest lesson of all, actually.
And if you can trust that, if you can trust that, you can really trust just about anything.
Right.
And that was the great thing that Brian did was that there were a couple of dilemmas that I had right after he died that were really whenever you have a paradox or a dilemma, that always mm-hmm. is a learning place. That's where the circle, you're not in a closed circle anymore. It doesn't match. So you have to change levels of understanding. And the first paradox was the worst thing that could ever happen just happened. Okay. Mm-hmm. And clearly it was supposed to happen.
Right.
So how do you grieve something that is clearly supposed to happen? That's one. And then the other was, okay, Brian knew more than I did.
Mm-hmm.
He was much more gifted than I was and obviously had much more vision than I did.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sad, okay? And he was joyful. You'll never see a more joyful child on that last as he ran towards his death.
Right.
And so now he knew more than I did, you know, like, why should I be sad? Or how can I be sad when this child who's teaching me is joyful? And so those were kind of questions that just haunted me for many years as I tried to, you know, understand what the grieving process was all about and the spiritual path, which is the same thing.
Yeah, and your book, I mean, at the end, when you explain that, it's really true. The, you know, the grief project has to do with an emptiness within you rather than something having to do with Brian.
Mm-hmm. Right. Brian pointed out this emptiness that I always had.
Right.
He brought it into the flesh.
Right.
And now that he died, all the conditions of that were gone. But the unconditional love that I felt for him, if anything, got stronger because all the conditions went away. So there I had my pain of my separation. And then I had this unconditional love. And the pain, the two things you need to heal universally are pain and love. Pain reveals what needs to be healed, and then love will heal. That's all you do is bring it into awareness, and it will take care of itself.
That's exactly right. So the answers are simple, but actually doing it in the physical world is not always, you know, just as simple as that.
Oh, no, we're always coming up with new and better ways to screw things up that need to be need to be fixed.
That's true.
So,
well, we're coming up to the end of our hour. Greg, is there any contact information or any last words of wisdom you'd like to leave the audience?
Sure. You're free to go to my website, beyondreason.info. That's I-N-F-O. And there you can read the first chapter, which is Brian's story, which a lot of people find very helpful if they're grieving, to understand that there's more to the grief process than most of us have been taught. And also you can get the book there, all the different formats, and audiobook, or you can go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble. And it's a very healing story. And Brian was such a gift, and to be able to share a story for me is a real gift, too. Right now, there's some interest in making it into a movie, and so we'll see what happens there. But this movie producer told me that he thinks that movies are the best way to get people to open their eyes. You can get, even the most hard-hearted businessman will go into a movie theater and cry for 90 minutes if it's a good movie. And kind of come to a new understanding. And
we're seeing it on an airplane, you know, where there's nothing else to do.
Right.
Which is true. Yeah. No, I think that's very true. And I think we live in a world where a lot of people don't read anymore, read books anyway.
Right.
They do videos and that type of thing, but don't read. So I certainly hope it is made into a movie. I think it's a great story and encompasses probably the hardest spiritual lesson anybody ever has to learn, which is the death of a child. Important story.
Right. Well, a lot of these kids are doing this. And,
yes, they are.
And if anytime, you know, most people are afraid of death and don't like to talk about it, but anytime somebody says, my husband died or my daughter died or something like that, and if you just offer to be able, you know, is there anything, you know, anything that you would like to tell me about, and you will hear the most amazing stories. And they're not paranormal, they're normal. And once our culture gets to the point where people are free to talk about that stuff, spiritual awareness will go make a huge increase.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. We've been talking with Dr. Greg Corbin, who's the author of Beyond Reason, Lessons from the Loss of a Gifted Child. Hopefully soon to be made into a movie, because they're wonderful, wonderful spiritual lessons connected with the story of Brian, the son he lost. Next week we will be interviewing the producer of Frequency of Genius, a DVD. And then Stephanie Marone is coming on the 22nd. She's the editor of the book Optimism, which is going to be released in about 2 weeks. Optimism is a compilation work. Steve Jobs, who recently died, of course, has a chapter. Jimmy Carter, Warren Buffett, Michelle Obama, Meryl Streep. And I have a chapter in that book as well. I talk about energy management and optimism. We'll be interviewing with Stephanie on the 22nd. On the 29th, we have a pre-recorded episode with Colin Bennett, Flying Saucers Over the White House. This is a story of the Blue Book Project. I was in the military for 13 years, and I was stationed at Wright-Patton. I kept hearing all these people who'd seen live aliens, and I became interested in the subject. And this is the original story of Project Blue Book and what really happened in the government. Something that I think we all need to know is disclosure may be coming up. Anyway, thank you very much for joining us, Greg. Thank you. I appreciate you taking the time today to tell the story. It's a great story and one that that touches all of our lives in some way.
Anyway, well, thanks for having me.
Thank you. This is Dr. Susan Kolb. Join us next week for Temple of Health Radio Show.